From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. U.S. job growth slowed sharply in May and wages rose less than expected, raising fears that a loss of momentum and economic activity could be spreading to the labor market, which then could put pressure on the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates this year. We shall see. The United States has reached an agreement with Mexico that heads off the start of tariffs on Monday. The deal announced by President Trump via tweet on Friday night is said to include plans to return migrants seeking asylum to Mexico, where they will remain until their claims can be processed. The Russian-American navies have accused each other of nearly causing a collision after the two warships came within as little as 50 feet of each other in the Philippine Sea. The Russian Pacific Fleet claimed that a U.S. guided missile cruiser was to blame as it accused the American ship, the USS Chancellorsville, of dangerous maneuvering. But the U.S. Navy later dismissed Moscow's claims as propaganda and accused the Russian destroyer's unprofessional crew of making an unsafe maneuver. The American sailors were forced to reverse full and steer away to avoid a collision. The Treasury Department imposed broad sanctions Friday on Iran's petrochemical and refinery industry for contributing funds to the financial arm of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which the State Department recently named as a terrorist organization. Charles R. Smith, author of Deception, with us. Charles, I think it's just a matter of time. Something's going to happen with Iran. What's your take?
There's a good possibility of a small conflict, but at this point, I suspect the Iranians are going to back off. We've seen them actually take some course that would appear to be backing off because we've clearly caught on to what they were doing, so they've had to compensate by trying to do something else. The missiles on those very small fishing boats were a giveaway of some nasty actions ready to go.
And the Saudi Arabians aren't too happy with Iran either, Charlie. Things could happen.
Well, the Saudis accused the Iranians of being behind a drone attack against one of their petrochemical facilities. That is a good possibility, and believe me, I think that was one of the things that brought the focus of our intelligence assets onto their communications, which of course led to us discovering that they were putting cruise missiles on very small wooden ships and sending them out.
Charles' website is softwar.net. Charles, thank you. Archaeologists have discovered a 1,000-year-old sarcophagus in Germany, uncovering the decomposed remains of what could be a former archbishop who died in the 11th century. NASA will begin allowing tourists to visit the International Space Station, but the trip is likely to be reserved for the ultra-rich who can afford the expected multi-million dollar price tag. NASA's hoping that by opening up the station to commercial travel, it can expand the market for space exploration while it aims to return humans to the moon by 2024. Look up in the sky. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Maybe a UFO. Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hi, Peter. What do you have for us this week?
George, yes, and there have been a lot of those unidentified objects over the last 3 weeks. I just checked our website, ufocenter.com, and note that our webmaster, loyal, hardworking webmaster, has updated our site with about 523 new reports. Although I mention that number because probably half of them are citing reports of those SpaceLink satellites that I've mentioned during my last two updates. I mention it one more time to invite any Coast listener who might wish to see how difficult a ufologist's work is to read some of those reports from May 23rd, 4th, and 5th, and stop to think that all of those reports are reports of the fundamentally the same phenomenon. It underscores just how difficult it is to put pieces together after an event has occurred and try to understand what's going on. More recently, one of the reports that I'd like to touch on came just this morning, written by a gentleman who describes himself as an adult male in his 60s. He writes that in early March of 1978, he was an Air Force ROTC cadet, and he was being given a tour together with nine of his ROTC colleagues, all probably in their teens or 20s, a tour of Eglin Air Force Base on a bus. They were being supervised by an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, and they drove across the flight line among very large hangars, he writes. And this case is posted to our website, George.
Okay.
So they were being driven by an open bay, and he spotted a disc-shaped craft perched on very spindly legs with Air Force insignias inscribed on the upper half of it. Very interesting report. They were able to look at it for an estimated 4 minutes, he writes, and suddenly their bus was descended upon by air police in full combat gear. They were all taken off the bus. They were taken into a series of offices and debriefed, told they must never say anything about it. And their cameras and film were confiscated, and he decided to write about it since he's got some serious health issues and feels the government probably won't have anything to, any recourse at this point in his life. In any event, I'll focus on that case this week and plan on giving more updates about more incidents next week, George.
You got it. Thank you, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Dr. Knowledge back with us. His books, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts, Knowledge in a Nutshell. Get ready for some really incredible stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back on a Friday night. George Norrie with you. Dr. Knowledge back with us has built one of the largest collections in the world of fascinating facts and stories that serve as a source for his Knowledge in a Nutshell book series. Dr. Knowledge served as the news and sports director of a station in Pittsburgh and also taught college journalism. He founded a news service called Century Features, which syndicated interesting tidbits to newspapers and radio stations worldwide. Here he is back on Coast to Coast with more tidbits. Hello, Dr. Knowledge.
Hello, George. Good being with you again.
You too. How have you been?
Just fine. Hope you have too.
Yes, all is well. More tidbits for us, I see.
Well, we never run out of goodies here. I'd love to take them out of our new book, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. That book is really a collection of what I thought was the best of what I've collected over the 50 years or so. Plus, I took a couple of years digging for a lot of new ones too, and so we can talk about some of those tonight.
How did you find them, and what's the criteria for picking them?
I just think you know, when that's what you're looking for, and I've been doing that for about 50 years. Things seem to pop out at you. I think I told the story before. It all started when I was a teenager in high school and got a job as an intern at a radio station in my hometown of Pittsburgh. And they had me working on July 4th, since I was the youngest one there.
Yeah.
And anyhow, the story came over the, we didn't have computers, of course, in those days. We had teletypes. And the story came over the teletype that three of the first five U.S. presidents all died on July 4th. Now, boy, that's an amazing fact.
That's strange.
Three of the first five presidents will all die on the same date, all of unrelated causes, is amazing in itself. And then of all the dates in the year, it was July 4th, and that's true. I looked it up. It was true. And so that started my collecting things like that. And just to answer that question, the second president, John Adams, died on July 4th, 1826. Same day, Adams was in Massachusetts, same day in Virginia, Thomas Jefferson died, July 4th, 1826. What are the odds on that? And then the fifth president, James Monroe, died on July 4th, 1831. So that started my collection. And by the way, George, we almost had four of the first five presidents dying on July 4th, because the fourth president, James Madison, died on June 28th. He almost made it.
Jeez.
To July 4th. So we would have had four of the first five all dying on July 4th. It's just incredible. You know, of all the dates in the year, it would be July 4th.
A lot of tidbits surrounding presidents, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there sure are.
Now, here's one question for you that you dug up for us. Which U.S. vice president was indicted for murder while he was serving as the vice president?
How about that? Aaron Burr, who was the vice president under Thomas Jefferson in Jefferson's first term.
He shot Alexander Hamilton, right?
Right, the guy on the $10 bill. They were bitter political enemies. They kept insulting each other, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, they had duels in those days, and Burr challenged Alexander Hamilton to a duel. They went to a field across the Hudson River from New York City. They were in New Jersey and had the duel. Some people say that Hamilton thought they would purposely miss each other, but in any case,
I wouldn't take that chance.
Burr did not miss Hamilton. He shot him and killed him and immediately left New Jersey, where he was indicted for murder. He continued to serve as vice president while under indictment for murder. He went back to Washington and finished out his first term. Jefferson did not pick him for a second term, but he did finish out the first term while under indictment for murder. How about that?
Was it illegal, though, to be in a duel?
Well, duels were common. Yeah, it was illegal, you know, if you killed somebody. That was, you know, I think the end of the duel period. We had duels in those days, sometimes not with...
sometimes swords and stuff that.
And that's not the end of the story, George, with Burr. After he finished his vice presidency, he was never brought to trial, by the way, for the indictment for murder. He went to the Southwest, which was not part of the United States then, in the Texas area, and wanted to form, the charges were that he wanted to form a new country in competition with the United States, and he was charged with treason. So he was not only charged with murder, but also with treason. And he was brought to trial for that. He was brought back to Washington, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presided over the trial. It was a long trial. He was finally found not guilty. And then, amazingly, George, he went back to his hometown in New York City, right across the river from where he killed Hamilton in the duel, and practiced law for about another 20 years after that.
Jeez.
Escaped all penalties and...
he was Teflon, for crying out loud.
That's right. Just an amazing story. But the most amazing part of that is here we had a sitting vice president, sitting as a vice president while under indictment for murder, and that was the story with Aaron Burr.
Now, you talk about the presidential income tax, and you say that George Washington didn't pay any at all during his time as president. Did we even have an income tax then?
Never paid a penny. Well, that's the reason he never paid a penny. He was lucky. We didn't have income taxes in those days. In fact, the first income tax wasn't put in until the Civil War in the middle 1800s, and then it was only temporary to raise money to fund the Civil War. After the war, the income tax went away again. It was tried in the 1870s, 1880s, but both times it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Finally, in 1913, Congress passed a resolution that became it was constitutional. It became a constitutional amendment in 1913 to make the income tax legal. And that's when it started. But all those early presidents, and in fact all the early people who lived in this country, never paid any income tax. There was no income tax. So we say, you know, George Washington never paid, he never paid any income tax, nor did anybody else until the 1860s. And then it really didn't start till in full until 1913. And then, by the way, it was a very small rate.
Not what it is today, that's for sure.
Right. It only touched the very rich, and then gradually they moved the rates down over the years. And in fact, presidents did not pay income tax in the beginning. It wasn't until the 1920s that Congress changed the rule that presidents also had to pay income tax.
You ask the question, which U.S. president carried the most states when he ran for re-election? Who would that be?
Yeah, there are two presidents tied for that. One is, of all people, Richard Nixon.
Aha. Uh-huh.
who carried 49 of the 50 states when he ran for re-election in 1972 against George McGovern. He carried even McGovern's home state of South Dakota. The only state he didn't carry was Massachusetts, which is a highly Democratic state.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ronald Reagan, in 1984, when he ran for a second term against Walter Mondale, he carried 49 of the 50 states, almost carried all 50, George. He almost carried Minnesota, Mondale's home state. He lost that state by only 4,000 votes.
Wow.
So he came very close to nobody else.
The sweep. Nobody would have done that.
50 states. So those two hold the record of carrying 49 of the 50.
Who had the less states as a president?
Well, poor William Howard Taft. He was president from, he elected president in 1908. He ran for a second term in 1912. And he didn't even finish second when he ran for re-election. Theodore Roosevelt, who had been president previously, was trying for a comeback and ran as a third-party candidate. Woodrow Wilson won the election. He was a Democrat. But finishing second was Theodore Roosevelt. And finishing third was the poor incumbent president, William Howard Taft. He carried only two states. Got only 8 electoral votes, and that was the poorest performance ever by an existing president, carrying only 2 states and not even finishing second when he ran for re-election. He finished third.
I know this next one. Of all the natural disasters in the U.S. in history, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, wildfires, which one caused the most deaths? I would say it was the hurricane in Galveston.
You're absolutely right.
6,000 to 12,000 people died.
Right. And, of course, in those days, one reason...
Was that 1900, by the way?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
You got that.
I read the books.
One reason for that, when you stop thinking about it, 1900, we had no radio or TV, and we didn't have the, science, good science that we have today. We didn't have airplanes tracking storms in those days. So people, were not prepared for it. They didn't know how serious it was. They didn't know the positioning of it as we do today. But not only that, it was a bad hurricane, and it was not only the hurricane itself, but the water that came in later that virtually wiped out Galveston. Galveston was much bigger than Houston at that time, but Galveston never did, recover its size. And nobody knows for sure exactly how many people died in that hurricane in the aftermath, but the estimates are, as you said, most experts say it's around 10,000 deaths, and that's the most we've had, as we've had recently, a lot of tornadoes and floods and wildfires and hurricanes, but this by far was the worst for the United States.
How come they can't pinpoint close to an exact number in deaths? I mean, in what I saw, 6,000 to 12,000 was the estimate.
Right.
How could they be off by 6,000?
Well, it's hard to, they didn't have the people we have today. They didn't have the expertise we have today. I think that the town was in such ruins that, it's probably many bodies that never were found there and were washed away. It was right on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico, and probably many of those bodies were washed out to sea and or out into the Gulf, and never found. So we never did get an exact count. But I think all experts do claim that was by far the worst natural disaster this country's ever had.
Which food innovation happened at a small diner, Louie's Lunch in New Haven, Connecticut?
That's amazing. There's a little diner, and it's still there, by the way.
It is. It is still there. That's right.
Louie's Lunch in New Haven, Connecticut. There were some. This was in the year 1900. There were some construction workers working nearby, and at lunchtime they came over to Louie's Lunch. There weren't many seats, and they wanted to take their lunch as a takeout order and take it back to their construction site and eat there. So they asked Louie, what they could take out, and he looked at his grill, and he had a bunch of hamburgers cooking on the grill, and then he realized he had some buns. So he said, "Here, I'll put these hamburgers in a bun for you, and you can take them back."
He toasted them, didn't he?
Yeah, and that was the way they were able to carry the hamburgers, because they put them in a bun. And that was the birth, believe it or not, of the hamburger on a bun. Previously to that, hamburgers were just served on plates, just like other meat.
All by itself.
But Louis Lassen is the guy's name that owned the diner, is credited with inventing the hamburger on
the bun. How about that? Dr. Knowledge will be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's Friday night, and Tim Banal, of course, being the news editor of the Coast to Coast AM website, comes up with some incredible stories for us every week. Tim, what do you have for us this week?
Hey, George, how you doing? Good to talk
Wonderful. Thanks.
We got a couple of stories here this week. I guess if there was a theme, it would be strangeness on TV from around the world.
Uh-huh.
Probably the best way to put it, yeah. And I didn't even really kind of make this connection until I was putting the stories together tonight. And I was like, oh, that's weird. These both are the same thing, in a sense. The first one is one of those, I'd classify it sort of as a story, one of those things that make you go, over in China earlier this week, a lot of residents in the northern part of China spotted a UFO. And essentially, pretty much, it is, I would have to say, a rocket launch, and folks can see a picture of it in the number two spot up on the carousel. But what made this interesting, very similar to sort of the SpaceX rocket launches and stuff you see that excite people over LA. What I thought was interesting is that the Chinese media picked up on it, and they were reporting it as a UFO. And it kind of makes you wonder, you know, we know UFOs are having a moment, if you will, here in America right now. It kind of makes you wonder, is there some kind of gamesmanship going on here, you know, that they wanted to show that they have, quote-unquote, UFOs, and here's one of theirs, you know? It kind of made me think a little bit, what's really going on here with that? The second story is one, it's kind of comical, it's kind of interesting. It's, as I say on the Coast website, it's sort of shades of a modern-day version of the Cottingley Ferry case.
Ah, that was a great picture, all those little ferries out there.
Oh, I know. I love that story. That's why I was really excited about this one. A morning TV program in England had on three women, Jessie Smart, Rebecca Broomfield, and Karen Kay. They call themselves the Fairy Whisperers, and they claim that they see fairies, that they can see fairies all over the place. And what was remarkable about this is you think it's kind of like a comical idea, but they treated this pretty seriously on this segment. It's about a 7-minute long segment. So folks, you know, after the show tonight or tomorrow, if you're hearing this, stop, take a moment, check it out. It's a pretty interesting segment. And then in the middle of the segment, one of the women shares a little clip, and you can see a still from it in the number one spot on the website of what she says is a fairy. And it's sort of a little glowing thing that was flickering around by a stream. And the host, they were kind of skeptical about it. They said that could be a moth. And she said, you know, yeah, it could be a moth or it could be a fairy. So I thought that was pretty interesting and a fun segment overall from that TV show over in England.
Great stuff, Tim. I don't know how you find all this stuff, but you do.
It's a fun adventure every day looking for the strange and unusual. I can tell you that, George.
Tim Banal, our news editor of CoastToCoastAM.com. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Dr. Knowledge. Dr. Knowledge, let's talk a little bit about a scientist who thinks he knows what aliens look like.
Yeah, George, we interviewed a guy for my book, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts, who, in fact, had a meeting with Albert Einstein at one time.
Uh-huh.
And he's done a lot of research on this as to what an alien might look like from another world. And he said a couple of interesting things. One, he thinks they would look pretty much like us because our bodies are pretty efficient. Although he said we might have three eyes instead of, they might have three eyes instead of two. An eye in the back of the head might be valuable. But the face itself, the head itself is very practical. The only other thing he thought, obviously, there might be a difference in skin color, but he said we already have that here. He also felt that they might have more appendages than we do, just like we have some, you know, insects with six legs or six arms. We might have an alien. There's no reason why we just have to have two arms and two legs.
That's true. Could have four arms and two legs, or four legs. Who knows?
But he felt, generally speaking, you know, you could have it's very logical to have one of those, the extra eye or the extra arms or legs. But on the other hand, our bodies are pretty efficient for what we do. And we look, our brothers and sisters out there may look pretty much the same as we do. But it's interesting to think about. And
He could be right. I mean, because we've had reports of, you know, human-looking ETs. They called them the Nordiques.
Right.
And who, you know what? If we're up there on the food chain at the top level, it could be the same everywhere.
Well, we also say, George, when you think about it, our galaxy has billions of stars, and there are billions of galaxies out there. And with all that, we can't be the only ones. There has to be advanced life somewhere else. All the billions and billions and billions of stars. In fact, somebody once said there are more stars out there and planets than there are grains of sand on our Earth. And when you think about it, just in our galaxy alone, there are a billion planets and stars, and that's just one of billions of galaxies.
You're talking about the diner Louis Lunch as the inventor of the hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
Why are hot dogs called hot dogs, Dr. Knowledge?
That's a great story. Originally, they weren't called hot dogs, but in the early 1900s, at a baseball game in New York, early in the season, it was a cool day, and in those days, the ballparks, they only had cold food to sell. They didn't have any hot food in the early days of baseball. And there was a concessionaire by the name of Harry Stevens, who became very well known in later years. He became the concessionaire at a lot of ballparks around the country. So he was sitting there, and he realized his poor vendors weren't selling much this day because it was a very cool day early in the season. And he said, boy, if I could only find something hot to sell, warm to sell, I could do pretty well. So he took a walk around the neighborhood, went to a butcher shop, and told the butcher his problem. He said, do you have anything warm I could sell? Anything? Well, the butcher had some sausages cooking on the grill, and he cooked some more. In fact, he took all the sausages he had, good supply of them, and put them on the grill and cooked the grill. The concessionaire, Harry Stevens, said, wait a minute, though. If I take the sausages, how are the people going to hold them? And the butcher said, well, there's a bakery next door. Why don't you go and see if they have some buns or something you could use? So he did that. He went next door. Sure enough, the baker had some buns. So he took the buns and the sausages back to the ballpark. He came back a few times to keep getting more and more as the game went on. But anyhow, he gave the sausage in the bun to the vendors, and they were going around the ballpark holding up the sausage in the bun. And that was the birth of the hot dog, but it didn't have the name yet. There was a cartoonist at the game that day. His name was Tad Dorgan. And in those days, many newspapers, and there were a lot of newspapers in those days, they ran cartoons on the front page. That was very
right.
common.
And they were original cartoons.
Yeah, exactly. And this guy was one of the best-known cartoonists in New York City. So he saw the vendors going around holding a bun with a sausage in it. And the sausage reminded him of a dachshund. So he drew a cartoon with the vendor holding up a bun with a dachshund in it. And he was going to title the cartoon Hot Dachshund. But he was on deadline, and he had to get the cartoon finished. And he realized at the last minute he wasn't quite sure how to spell dachshund. So, this is a true story. He took the easy way out, and instead of calling it Hot Dachshund, he just made it Hot Dog. And that was the birth of the name. Well, we know that story is true, George, because there's his original cartoon naming the hot dog is in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. There's a copy of that cartoon that gave us the name Hot Dog.
I bet he sold a million of them.
That's just a great story, isn't it?
It sure is. Yeah. Talking about baseball, you say that it's how many outs there are in an inning. I would say six.
Well, you're great. You are correct. But most people, I think, might say three.
That's a half an inning.
Yeah, you can have fun with that question. How many outs are there in an inning? I think most people offhand, you can try this on people. I think most people offhand might just say three because, you know, three outs, the inning's over. But it's really only the half inning
that's
over. The first inning has six outs. The second inning has six outs when you take the first half and the second half of the inning. So the correct answer is six, as you had it. But I think most people might say three.
Now, here's another one. I'm going to answer this one for you, too, see if I'm right. But your question is, how can a baseball pitcher be credited with a win in a game without ever throwing a pitch to a batter?
Mm-hmm.
I would say he is in the inning and is taken out, but he's the pitcher of record, and then his team scores a run in the next inning or something.
Well, without ever throwing a pitch, though, the answer we have in our book is there's a tie game. They bring in a relief pitcher in the top of the ninth. The opposing team has a runner at first base with two out. The relief pitcher comes in, and before he throws a pitch to the batter, he throws to first base, picks the runner off first base. The inning is over.
And then his team scores.
His team scores a run in the last.
And
the
he's the winner of record.
Because he's the pitcher of record.
I like that.
And he never threw a pitch to a batter.
I was close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can win some money on that bet, too. In our book, we do have questions like that that you can sort of trick people on. And if I may mention, our website is knowledgeinanutshell.com, folks.
Yep, we've got that linked up for you, too, at coast-to-coast.
Thank you. And the name of the book is The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts.
Is that that's the latest one, right?
Yeah, yeah. What I did, George, was take what I considered the best of all the stuff I had over the years, and then, as I say, it took the last couple of years also adding new things. And we have about 300-and-some pages and lots of questions you can quiz folks on. Makes a nice Father's Day gift.
We'll take some questions with you next hour, by the way, Dr. Knowledge. And not that I want people to stump you, but they might have some of their own little trivia questions for
they
you.
They might stump me. That could be.
What is so strange about U.S. coins you talk about?
Well, this is a funny one, George. This is really odd. Just about everybody calls the 1 cent coin a penny, right? We don't say one
cent,
we say penny. Just about everybody calls the 5 cent piece a nickel. And yet the words penny and nickel are not on the penny or nickel. It says 1 cent or 5 cents. And yet the dime, the 10-cent piece, everybody calls that a dime. That is on the coin, one dime. And the quarter, everybody doesn't say a 25-cent piece. They say a quarter. And the word quarter is on the quarter.
That's on that, too. That's right.
So when I was writing a book, I called the mint. And I said, well, you know, why in the world, you know, we have dime on the dime and quarter on the quarter. Why don't we put penny on the penny and nickel on the nickel? And the guy I talked to said, geez, I don't know. He says, I guess just because we've always done it that way. So I tried to talk to somebody else. And I said, you know, any consideration about changing that? And they felt, no, since it's always been that way, that's the way it'll be. But the next time you look at a penny or a nickel, realize those words aren't on it. It says 1 cent or 5 cent. But yet look at the dime, and it does say one dime. And the quarter does say one quarter.
Fascinating tidbits, to be sure. You talk about two U.S. presidents who were so popular, nobody ran against them. Would that be George Washington and James Monroe?
You are absolutely right, as usual.
Yes.
That is correct. Nobody ran against Washington. I mean, he was considered the obvious, while they were writing the Constitution and everything, he was the obvious choice to be president. He had no competition at all. Nobody ran against him, either for his first term or his second term. On the case of James Monroe, he ran for a second term. He's not that famous, really, James Monroe. He's not considered one of the greatest presidents, I wouldn't say. But when he ran for a second term, things were very good in the country. It was 1820. It was called the era of good feeling. And nobody thought that they could beat Monroe when he ran for second term, so nobody ran against him. Now, he did not get all the electoral votes only because there was one elector who wanted Washington to hold the record of being the only president voted unanimously, getting all the electoral votes. So this one elector voted for somebody else, not because he was against Monroe, but just because he wanted to protect Washington's record. But Monroe got all the electoral votes but one, and won the election, obviously, and nobody did run against him. The one electoral vote he got was really not an opponent. It was just a vote to preserve Washington's record. So nobody ran against Monroe. Nobody ran against Washington. But I don't think we'll ever see that again.
Famous people who have had food named after them.
This is a fun question. You can think of, we name a few of them here, but your folks, your listeners,
they can jump in with us next hour.
Well, our former here, some are just the ones I can remember here. Our former Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice.
All right.
We've had actors Kevin Bacon, Jack Lemmon, John Candy, Halle Berry. And then here's a funny one. We had two Supreme Court justices. One was Felix Frankfurter. honest to goodness, that was his name, Felix Frankfurter. He was on the Supreme Court for a long time. And Warren Burger was Chief Justice for a while. So we had a Frankfurter and a Burger as Supreme Court justices. And then there was that congressman who got into trouble. Anthony Weiner. Remember him?
Oh, yeah. Named after a hot dog.
Yeah, and then L.L.
Bean. I think.
L.L. Bean. Then we've had some baseball players. Mike Trout, who's a good star now. Daryl Strawberry was a pretty good ball player. Coco Crisp. The women's soccer player, one of the great women's soccer players, Mia Hamm. And the Pittsburgh Steelers had a pretty good linebacker, Jack Hamm. And then, of course, the singer, Meatloaf. He went by that name. But most of these other names, by the way, though, were their real names.
How about the Margarita Pizza?
Yeah, there you go.
After the Queen.
That's exactly right. That's where it got its name. That's right.
Soufflé Diana?
Good. You're very good, George.
Doing a little homework here. And Beef Stroganoff, there was a guy named Stroganoff.
Yeah, that's right.
I love these things. Indeed.
You can have some fun thinking of more, and they're more current people, too, that have food names.
Well, the phones are ringing off the hook right now, Dr. Knowledge, so let's see if they will toss a question your way or maybe just ask you a question to be sure. And very quickly, you said there was a period of almost 4 years after World War II there was no U.S. president. Was that when Roosevelt died?
No U.S. president. There was no U.S. president in the White House.
In the White House.
For
where was
4 years after World War II. And the reason was the White House in 1950 would have been 150 years old. It was built in 1800, and it was in terrible condition.
They remodeled it.
So they had a major remodeling, reconstruction job to do, and they felt it would be not good for the president to live there and work there while all this construction was going on. It was major construction.
That's an interesting tidbit. Okay, Dr. Knowledge with us. We'll take an hour of phone calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM.